Okay. What?
You put up this slide? No, they are still really bad. I think I, because of part of the work that I we'll try to
close one of these. So, does anybody have answers to that?
Did people understand? Okay, now that's better, I guess. Except I just don't know what's going on outside.
Yeah. So I was asking whether if, you know, we were talking about similarity metrics and we looked at bag-based similarity metric last time, and we will look at vector-based similarity metric today. I already mentioned, in fact, one of the slides, I guess I should point out, which I added earlier. That first of all, this was something that I mentioned after the class, it was mentioned indirectly in the class, that it really matters less as to what exact similarity metric you use, and it matters more that there are certain consistent properties that are satisfied by the similarity metric. Okay. So for example, one of the issues is that partial matches should be allowed. So if you give keyword query, then let's say you have 20 words in the query and there's a document which is missing one of those keywords, you shouldn't just say completely irrelevant. Okay, so that seems like a reasonable idea. So anything which is Boolean is probably not as good as anything which allows score based on partial match. The second issue is weighted matches should be allowed. Not all keywords, even if the user provides keywords without providing any weight to them, you should not necessarily assume all keywords are equally important. Okay. So for example, if the query is for red sponge and a document that has just read should be seen to be sort of less relevant than a document that has just has the word sponge. Unless, of course, your entire document corpus is about sponges. In which case, you should do the opposite. You should say the document that has sponge is less important than the document which has read in it. Okay, so somehow you want to be able to allow partial weights. I mean, you want to allow differing weights for the words, and you also want to, a reasonable point is to say that you want to give less importance to common words. Words that are very common across all documents should not be all that important. They are not distinguishing. Okay. So in fact, one interesting way of thinking about it is, remember, in the background of all this, you know, the user query is supposedly going to split the documents into relevant and non-relevant. So the question is, what features of the document are likely to be most predictive of whether it's going to be relevant or not? And if it's a, if a feature like such as a word is present in every document, then it can't potentially, it cannot possibly be discriminating enough because everybody has it. Okay? And so, we'll, you know, that's another useful idea. The third idea, of course, which I talked about at the end of the class is relevance should not depend upon the size. Okay? So, because if it does, then you can just, suppose you have, you know, document one has been shown to be more similar to the query than document two. And document 2 is like close, but not quite, you know, little less similar. So what you can do is you can just, you know, concatenate document 2 to itself 15 times. So it becomes lot longer. And if your similarity somehow depends on the length of the document, it might wind up increasing because now the document is longer. Okay. And if you're not careful, in fact, you could have this problem. And so you need to normalize. So whatever similarity metric you are using, it better not depend upon how large the document is. Okay. So these are some of the useful ideas that you want to keep in the back of your mind when you look at a similarity metric and say, ranking metric, and say, is it a good ranking metric or not? Okay. So having said that, I asked this other question in the class, on the blog, which is, all search engines basically rank the, assuming that you figured out the perfect ranking function, they're going to rank files in terms of how similar are they according, you know, to the query. So ranking function is your similarity function. That's what we decided, right? So you're going to basically say, this is most similar to the query, this is next most similar, this is the next most similar, and so on. So that's what, you know, so it's clear that if all I want is the most similar single document to the query, what I should do is pick the first document which has the highest similarity. Okay? If I want to give entire set of documents that are relevant, this is still reasonable. But the worry is, suppose I'm only going to show you the top 10 results. Should I care about, how would I, having shown the first one, am I going to change anything in showing the second one? And I said, consider the possibility of that the document corpus has near duplicate. Certain documents are almost mirror copies of each other. Okay, now having said that, you know, suppose one of the copies has found out to be, you know, you found that that has the highest similarity. So obviously its mirror copy also will have very high similarity. Would you like to show top 10 mirror copies of the same document to the user? Obviously not, because then they won't come back to you. More importantly, here is another way of thinking about it. Remember, the query we said is only supposedly partially indicative of what the user is really looking for. Oftentimes, the query is actually ambiguous. So there may be multiple possible meanings to the query. So you are better off showing in the top 10 results a diverse set of top 10 results rather than just single one. So my example that I was showing yesterday to somebody else was, so if I search for come home party, which is the most important query on Google, I come first, that I'm at least the best in the come home parties apparently. But then there are a couple of other come home parties who come in the top 10. So they will also use Google, because at least they won't get mad at the search engine. Okay. Whereas if they showed all 10 pages, 10 copies of my homepage at the top 10, right, the other guys are not going to be looking for it. And more importantly, some user who is looking for a come home party might be looking for me or one of those other guys. Okay. So the point I'm trying to bring is, it's true that you want to rank the results in terms of how similar they are to the query. But that is only for the first result. The query that the document that's the most similar to the query is the one that you want to output. The next document that you're going to output should be the one that has the highest residual relevance. Given that you have seen this, how much more interested are you likely to be to see this other page? Okay? And one way of thinking about it is, so remember that in fact all of IR is about relevance. So you really want to do most relevant, second most relevant, which takes into account residual or marginal relevance. Okay? This is ideally, if you know how to compute relevance. And we have decided to compute relevance by using similarity. So the first result would be the most similar. The second result is going to be what? In a way, if you're thinking in terms of similarities, you want to have the second result, which is highest similarity but also highest distance from the first one. Okay? So imagine, you know, if in the space of here is a space of documents in, you know, in terms of the distances, and here are some, okay? And then, let's say the similarity, let's think in terms of the, this is the similarity, okay? We'll assume that this is 1.0, and this is 0.0, similar, okay? Here are some documents, okay, and here are some. Now these documents clearly are very low similarity to the query to begin with. These clusters seems to be the highest similarity to the query. But you should resist the temptation of giving the entire cluster one after other after other. Why? Because once you pick this guy, then everybody else from this cluster are too close to this. And you want to provide the next result, not only high similarity, but high dissimilarity with respect to other results. Okay? Keep that in mind, and in fact, most reasonable search engines do this. You know, if you look at either Yahoo or Google search, they will talk about, they will try to show not just the top 10 results of the same type, but top 10 results which are likely to be different from each other. And oftentimes they'll even tell you that similar pages, so for example, they might show you this page and say, if you want more pages from this cluster, click on the similar pages, and then you'll get more of them. Okay? You could think of it either in terms of increasing the marginal relevance of the next page I'm showing, or they're also sort of spreading their, they're hedging their bets so that if they actually get wrong in terms of what you are really looking for, okay, giving 15 copies of the first cluster is not going to be helpful. Okay, so an example query of this, as I said, common point, the other one is Bush. You could be looking for George Bush, you could be looking for, you know, Kalahari Bushmen or anything. And so you need to give multiple possible meanings, you know. And one way of thinking about it in terms of distances is that the top 10 results should be the most similar to the query and most distant from each other. Okay? Again, that's the idea, and whether we or not we'll do it is a different issue, but that's what you should consider in mind. So that's basically the thing that I was asking you to think about there. So going back to the bag of words similarity metric, we looked at it last time. Yes. Okay, so again, first decide what should be the optimal thing to do if you have infinite resources, and then start cutting. Okay, I mean, what should be the optimal thing to do if you have infinite resources? You should actually figure out what it is that the user is trying to look for. And since we don't have too many resources, we gave that up right away, you know, and we are not doing NLP, we are not talking to users. Your point is very well taken, okay, that in fact, more often than not, actually checking to see that two documents are distant enough from each other is too costly. So, you know, search engines try to do it, but they don't really guarantee. Okay? And in fact, when you write your search program, you know, more likely than not, you would just sort them in the order of rank, order of the similarity. But, you know, the whole point of computer science, the whole point of any problems is knowing optimal and still not doing it, as against being ignorant and proud of it. Okay, so you know at least what's the ideal thing you're supposed to do if you had infinite resources. Because one day you might have infinite resources. And then what do you do? Okay, so you should know what is the right thing to do and what, and if it does, if it takes too long, then you'll start cutting corners. Okay? And in particular, that's, you know, finding documents which are far enough from each other is going to be, you know, requiring inter-document comparison. And if you are looking for like n documents, you're talking about n-square comparisons now. As again, as n times q as against OM comparison, which is query to each of the documents. Okay, this is costlier, but the right thing to do. Okay, so again, when things go wrong, you should at least know why they go wrong. And another way is, you know, since we are talking about this, one thing that people wind up doing is, you know, there are many search engines. How many of you have seen things like Vivisimo, which is a search engine that provides clusters of search results? Okay, there are many search engines. One is Vivisimo, but there are other search engines which, rather than provide top 10, they try to cluster their results. And what they do is essentially one way of dealing with this problem. What they would do is they'll take the top 100 in terms of the similarity, okay, and basically plot them and realize that there are clusters. So compute the clusters first. So if you showed the, if I showed you those are the groups of documents, you would have said, yeah, you know, look like this is one cluster, this is one cluster, this is one cluster, that's one cluster. And so you would then provide one document from this cluster, one from here, one from here, one from here. Okay? So why do search engines do clustering? Exactly this. Okay, that's one way of getting the same effect, but after the fact. Okay? In fact, knowing what is the right thing to do and not doing it upfront allows you to bring it back later as post-processing steps. You know, knowing that natural language processing is the right thing to do, knowing that asking user what they really are looking for is the right thing to do, and not doing it allows you to then bring it back piecemeal. You know, we'll see that relevance feedback, start grudgingly asking user what are you actually looking for. Okay. Okay. So the other model that we are going to look at is, instead of thinking of these as bags, you can think of these as vectors. If you're thinking of them as bags, then you would essentially have taken, you know, set or bag similarity, which is like Jaccard similarity measure. Okay. If you could think of them as vectors, and all that means is now these are the various dimensions, T1, T2, T3, T4, T5, T6 are the dimensions, and D1 is a vector in this term space. And its coefficient for T1 is 24, for T2 is 21, etc. Okay? So this is another way of thinking about it. And if you look at these bags as vectors, then you can start using vector similarity matrix that you know of. Okay? Now, what are the usual vector similarity metrics that you already know? First of all, so the kind of vector similarity metrics that you know are, so if you suppose you have only two keywords, okay, so here is K1 and here is K2, right? So you have one document is this, that means let's say this is 10 and this is also 10, so it has 10 of K1 and 10 of K2, okay? And here is, you know, another one. So maybe this has, what? You know, this is 1 of K1 and 3 of K2. 1 of K2 and 3 of K1. Two different vectors. So now I know that these are two vectors. I can start talking about similarity between the vectors. Okay, what kind of similarities can I talk about, given that these are vectors? One idea for vector similarity is take the distance, Euclidean distance between the tips of the vector. Because there are two points, right? Vectors are points, and you can take the Euclidean distance. Now, upfront, if I take the Euclidean distance, what's wrong with it? Are there, you know, for every similarity metric I give you, ask yourself if any of the cardinal rules that similarity metrics are supposed to satisfy, are they being violated? Okay? So if I do this, let's say, if I take distance between point here and this point here, Euclidean distance, will I be able to return documents which are partially matching keywords? Or would I be requiring that all keywords be present? It allows partial match because it doesn't matter. Okay. Now, how about the requirement that you be size insensitive? It's not going to be size insensitive, right? So suppose one simple thing you want to have is that if you have a document D1 and you have a document D1, which is just a concatenation of D1 to itself 5 times, do you want them to be similar or not? You want them to be highly similar. Would they be highly similar with this way? No. Okay? So clearly what you must be doing is, so what happens in that kind of a scenario is this would be the original D1 and this would be D1, 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 D1 point. And that's not good, because then you will wind up taking distance between those two points, which can keep increasing based on the length. So what's a simple idea that you can do to make this normalize? No, don't go into the angle yet. Don't go into the angle yet. Just normalize the vector. Just normalize the vector. All you need to do is normalize the vector. Now, normalizing the vector is very easy. You take the unit vector in that direction. Okay, how do you take the unit vector in that direction? You know the magnitude of a vector. You divide each coefficient by its magnitude of the entire vector. That will give you the unit vector in that direction. Okay? So, one of the things that you would do in vector space similarity is using unit vectors. Okay? That's the way you take care of the normalization. Now, having done the unit vectors, then you can take the distance between the tips of the vector. Okay? So, suppose I now have agreed that irrespective of how big the real vectors are, I will only take the unit vector in those directions. So, this would be the unit vector in this direction, this would be the unit vector in this direction. Right? So then, what I need to do is take the distance between these. Now the question, of course, is how do I define the distances between these vectors? One idea, of course, one simple idea, as I said, is that all of you happen to know is Euclidean distance, which is actually fine. In fact, it's hard to argue that Euclidean distance over normalized unit vector is a bad similarity metric. You cannot upfront argue that, you cannot put a bullet and say, look, you know, it's a bad similarity metric. There's nothing really wrong with it. Okay? But there are other ways of also looking at the similarity metric. One of which is dot product. The basic idea is, you would say really the distance is, you know, sort of what we are looking for in doing this distance is this angle really. Okay? If two vectors are in the exact same direction, then they are identically similar. If not, they are going farther and farther from each other. Okay? So one idea is to take dot product, which essentially takes the projection of one vector onto the other vector. Okay? Now the nice thing about dot product is actually much cheaper to calculate. So if you have K1, K2 is one document, and K1 dash, K2 dash is another document. Dot product is K1, K1 dash plus K2, K2 dash. That's it. Right? Okay. Now, if you then divide this by the the actual length of K1, K2 and K1 dash, K2 dash, which is going to be the normalization aspect. Remember that even projection would be size dependent. If you are longer, you're going to leave a longer projection. If you are shorter, I mean with the same angle, if you have a longer vector, it leaves a longer projection. Right? So again, you would wind up doing normalization, which can also be thought of as, imagine these being unit vectors to begin with, and then you are taking the dot product between the unit vectors, and that would just be cosine of the angle between the vectors. Okay? And it has a nice property. It has a nice property that if it is 0 is the angle, then cosine of theta is 1, the similarity 1, and if it becomes 90 degrees, it becomes 0. Okay, so that's another way of defining similarity. And there is an obvious upper and lower bounds on the similarity metric. That's another thing that I should actually have written. For any good similarity metric, there should be an obvious upper and lower bound, so that you know what does it mean to be most similar and what does it mean to be least similar. Okay? So that is the celebrated cosine theta metric, cosine distance. That's the cosine distance between vectors. And there are a bunch of slides here that essentially try to say whatever I just said on that board. Let's see, so Euclidean distance can be used, dot product distance can be used, you should normalize, and the reason you normalize is so that you are not size sensitive. Now, let's check what actually happens. So, why do people use cosine similarity metric as against Euclidean similarity metric? As I said, it's not obvious. In fact, one can say that Euclidean distance, at least there's no obvious, well-known upper bound between two vectors, right? Whereas cosine theta, upper bound is 1 and lower bound is 0. Okay, but here is another way of looking at it. Go back to our example. Remember this example for 10 documents. The top 5 were database documents, and the bottom 5 were statistics documents. You kind of agreed with that because these have more database SQL index terms and these have more regression likelihood linear terms. And there is some leakage, you know, the once in a while a database guy is talking about likelihood. Okay, but still it really is a database document. Now the question of course is, suppose I computed the inter-document similarity. Inter-document similarity, okay? So that would be, you know, D10 by 10 matrix, such that the diagonal entries would be how similar is D1 to itself, D2 to itself, D3 to itself, Dk to itself. Okay? And everything else would be how similar are they to the other guy. Okay? And now here is a picture basically it's showing that for the high values, you make the color is such that the gray scale is such that if it is a high similarity, you put more white. And if it's a low similarity, you put more black. So I just, you know, visually represent it. So notice that this is the Euclidean similarity. This is what Euclidean similarity says between the 10 by 10 similarity matrix. And this is what cosine similarity says. Can you now argue that somehow cosine similarity is better? Clearly all of them agree. I mean, any similarity measure worth its salt better have highest values on the diagonal. If you are not similar to yourself, who are you similar to? Okay, if people start saying you're more similar to other things than you, then you're in trouble. So it's not a good similarity measure. So it's clearly these have to be high. Okay, that's not surprising. And this guy has a wide diagonal, this guy has a wide diagonal. But what's more useful is you sort of agree that these guys are together more similar to each other, these guys are together more similar to each other, and they are not, across the clusters, they are not as similar. And that's extremely clearly seen in the cosine theta metric. You can see that D1 to D5 are very similar to D1 to D5. They're white. And they wind up being less similar to D6 to D10. And vice versa. This is the closest I will ever get to in arguing why cosine theta metric is actually a better metric. Okay, that's it. In fact, you know, Euclidean distance almost has everything that you want. Okay, so does Jaccard similarity with normalization. Okay, so again, remember that what matters is the properties of the similarity metric rather than the exact formula you use. And this winds up being everybody uses this. Yes?
Actually, it's talking about the triangle which you're talking about. So it has nothing to do with this, but that paper which you sent us to read, the SIGIR paper about Google influencing people and all that stuff. So in that, they had these judges who ranked the relevance of the top 10 documents. And the triangles weren't always 1 or 100%.
So have you heard of the So have you heard of the Charlie Chaplin lookalike contest that was held in Denmark, and Charlie Chaplin came third. So it's not surprising. Humans are not particularly good at deciding, you know, that a document is more similar to you. So it tells you more about the guys doing the similarity than anything else. Okay? So keep in mind that Charlie Chaplin was number third in the Charlie Chaplin lookalike contest, and you know, everything will be clear. Okay. But I mean, you would think if humans weren't there, you know, I mean, any reasonable thing would have said a document is most similar to itself. If it winds up being more similar to some other document, then there's something wrong, clearly. You know, so. Okay. So what would you do to answer the queries? In all these cases, you have like a query like database and index, you convert it into a vector. Okay. So this database and index, if you remember, the way we wound up doing it is that first one is database and the index is the third one. Okay. So database index query becomes 101000. Okay. And that's your vector. And it's in the same space as the document. Now you take the cosine similarity between the document and the vector. That's it. Okay. This is basically what you're doing in computing vector similarity. Are there any questions on this stuff? You have to obviously, you know, for each document and the, you know, you take the query and compare, you know, do the cosine theta between that query and each other document, and then rank the document. If you ignore this second effect I said, which is residual relevance issue, then all you need to do is just list them in the order of similarity. Okay? Now, so this distance, it turns out, so in this case, D1 is 0.70 similar to this query, D2 is 0.77, D3 is 0.58, etc. Okay? So obviously, if you have to pick the most similar one, D5, according to whatever computation you are making, D5 is the most database-y index-oriented document. Okay? It's not particularly bad because it does have 43 instances of database and 20 instances of index, and everybody else has much fewer indexes of index. Okay? Now the next part is that extra thing that I told you about, which is, you know, we want to also take into account normalization of the term value. So the normalization of the weight given to individual terms so that common words are less important. Okay. So there actually are two things that you do. One is to actually sort of normalize, because the frequencies can be wildly different in different documents. One thing you would do is for each term, you consider, you normalize its frequency by dividing each term's frequency in the document by the maximum frequency any term has in that document. Okay, suppose you have 5 possible terms, 5 possible keywords. Your document has 70 instances of T5, and that's the maximum number any instance, any term has. And if T1 is 20 instances, then really T1's relative weight with respect to T5 is 20 by 70. And T5 would be 70 by 70. Okay, this would be just term frequency normalized. Okay, now the other issue, of course, is how, now in computing the term frequency, all you're doing is considering a single document at a time and normalizing the frequency of the terms in that document with respect to other terms in that document. Okay, what about the commonality, how common is a word, in the sense whether it is appearing in every document or only some document. Okay. To do that, basically what you'll wind up doing is this idea of inverse document frequency, which essentially considers the number of, the fraction of the documents in the corpus that have this word. The fraction of the documents in the corpus that have this word. If that fraction is 1, that means everybody has that word, then you clearly think it's a completely common word and it has no real use. So its IDF, its inverse document frequency weight, should be close to zero. If only this document has, only one document has this word, then it's an extremely indicative word. Okay? So what you want to do is, for the inverse document frequency, you need to consider some measure which is the total number of documents in the corpus divided by the number of documents in which the ith keyword appears. Okay? And so ni over n is the fraction, and the inverse of that is what you're interested in. I know you normally take a logarithm of it. There are two reasons why you might want to do logarithm. One, of course, is, you know, the number of documents in any corpus is going to be hugely large. And so, you know, n over ni is likely to be a really large number. And, you know, compared to the term frequency, inverse document frequency winds up having much larger value. And so it winds up dominating everything. That's one way. That's a practical way of thinking about it. Another way is to actually realize that log, so if you think of this, you can think of ni over n is the probability that ni occurs in a random document. That's the probability that ni occurs in a random document. And it turns out that those of you who have done anything related to information theory, for example, if you did decision trees in AI, you know the information theory tells you that the best way to measure the information content of an event is minus p log p. Okay, minus p log p. And you can think of what we are taking, what you are doing here is minus log p, essentially. Because minus going into the logarithm converts, you know, turns it upside down. Okay, so this is like, yeah, it works in practice. Does it work in theory? And I just told you that it also works in theory, because I can give you some reason why it is theoretically justified. You can think of IDF as being sort of proportional to the information content of the word. Okay, so having computed the IDF and TF for each of the keywords, then the normal idea is to say that the weight of each keyword in the document would now be converted into term frequency of that keyword times the inverse document frequency. Okay? So inverse document frequency would be zero if this word is present everywhere. And term frequency would be high if this word is more present in this document with respect to other words in this document. Okay? It's important to understand that TF is document specific. TF depends on only the single document. IDF is document corpus dependent. Whether or not you are common depends on what other documents are there in the corpus. Remember, I was telling you that it's not obvious that red is more common than sponge. What you have is a document corpus full of facts about sponges, then sponge is more common than red. Okay? And this is important because when you're computing this, you know, one of them requires a global. So for example, imagine the following thing. Suppose as the documents keep getting put in into the corpus, for each document you can compute the TF weight for each of the keywords, because the TF weight only depends upon the other keywords in the document. And now when a new document is put in, the previous document's TF weight doesn't change. Because this document didn't change, the fact that more documents came in doesn't matter. What about the IDF weight? In the beginning, it used to be, you know, 10 documents, and most of them, you know, a couple of them had sponges, a couple of them had red. And then you introduce 1,000 more documents, all of them have sponge, and very few of them have red. Now all of a sudden, sponge became very common word. So the IDF actually changes as the corpus changes. So if you're writing your search engine, IDF is something that depends on the corpus. So you would have to recompute it every once in a while. TF doesn't. Okay. Now, all of this basically saying that for each document, I would have the, you know, I would compute the TF, and then once I know that the document purpose isn't changing, I can also compute the IDF for each of the keywords, and then the weight of each keyword in that document would be TF times IDF. Okay. This is basically a big deal in the IR community. People, especially interesting is the IDF part, which essentially says the more common word should have less weight, which we agreed is a useful thing to do for all similarities. So you throw this in, this is sort of an orthogonal issue from whether you are using Jaccard similarity or whether you are using cosine theta similarity or whether you are using Euclidean similarity. All this is going to change is you thought the vector for D1 was like this, but really the vector for D1 is more like that. Because after you change, maybe its length also would change, you know. Now even with TF and IDF, the vector is going to be non-unit vector. So when you take cosine theta, then you will take the unit vector of that direction and take the cosine theta with respect to that. Okay? Now the other issue of course is what do you do with the query term? This is all I did tell you was how to change the document's own representation. Just so that we all keep this in mind. Now each of the documents is a vector. Remember that. There is no document anymore. A document is a vector. It used to be a bag, it became a vector. And the vector now, you know, originally it was just a vector where the coefficients are the number of times each keyword appears in the document. Now, after this TF-IDF weighting, the coefficients are actually based on the normalized frequency times the inverse document frequency of that term. Okay? So the document's representation is both based on itself and other guys in the corpus. Now the question, of course, is retrieval depends on when you give a query, you compare the query to the document. Right? So the question is, do you change the query too? Now, how do you go about changing the query? One idea, of course, is to say, well, query is a document. Remember, the one of the tenets of IR is to say that query is a document too. So that's why we actually think in terms of similarity between documents, and they use the same thing for the queries too. Okay? And original IR in kind of LexisNexis kinds of systems, you can provide a paragraph as a query. Okay, but and notice that nothing I have said until now requires that the query be just 5 keywords long. It could be a paragraph. Okay, so instead of looking for giving a query, suppose I give you an entire page and say, get me documents which are similar to this page. You do the exact same thing as against whether you have 2 keywords. Okay, the theory is the same. And in fact, you are more likely to be correct because that one has, you know, more, presumably if you wrote like a whole page describing what you're looking for, you're more likely to have put enough information about what you're looking for. Okay, so now, given that everybody knows that the query is actually really short, and it's not really as big as a document, so you know, the one first idea is to actually think of query itself as a document and compute the TF-IDF based like this. But knowing that query has much fewer words, what you might do is sort of do it in such a way that some offset is provided in essence for each of the terms. Okay? So one idea here, for example, is the term frequency for the query term is given as 0.5 plus 0.5 times the TF. This is just the TF. Okay, the frequency of the ith keyword in the query divided by the maximum frequency of any keyword in the query. Okay, all I did was I'm basically saying this cannot be less than 0.5 by putting this 0.5. And then it can be as high as 1 based on whether this is also 1. Okay, and then of course multiply this whole thing by the IDF. Okay, now why do I do this? There really is not much of a great theory for it other than to say that you realize that if in fact the user wrote an entire page on the on what they are looking for. They may have touched upon more words, and so not too many words would have had a zero weight. Whereas if you don't do this, then most words will actually wind up having zero weight. Okay, point one. And point two is maybe the user would also have considered repeating, you know, that word multiple times in the document if they actually, you know, express their entire information. Okay. Now, these are basically magic parameters, and you know, this is something that seems to work in track style scenarios where, remember we talked about track evaluation, you know, people do use it. Actually, most search engines don't use it at all. Most search engines just say, to heck with it, we have done TF IDF and we'll assume the query is just a query. We won't even do TF or IDF for the query. So do TF IDF for the document and don't do it for the query. Okay, that's also fine. Well, now what is fine? You know, you know, you have to once in a while wake yourself up and say, who am I trying to impress? I have started by taking a page which is written in English and started by saying, well, it really doesn't matter what the sentences say. If there are 15 instances of the word was, then you just say 15 was it in this page and 17 thus in this page. So you basically lost the entire meaning of the page in any reasonable sense of the word. And that's your starting point. And from there you're trying, and then your user doesn't help you, doesn't want to tell you what they're looking for, they'll just give you keywords. That's another starting point. Given these two, it's surprising that anything works at all. Okay? So so keep that in the back of your head, and you know, you should only be surprised that these things actually make sense. Not that they don't make sense. Okay, of course, this is also possible to allow users to give the keywords to the weights, the weights to the keywords. Okay, so the users can say, I'm looking for, let's say, red sponge, but I'm really looking, the red is very important, and sponge, you know, it's okay. So how much important? Well, 7 times red and 1 time sponge. I can say that. If you say this, this model can use it. Now, but this is, we are stuck with users who don't want to use Boolean logic and who really don't want to write paragraphs. So do you think they're going to say 7 times sponge and 7 times red and 1 time sponge? No. Okay. But if they do, you can use it. In fact, one way you can actually do this, you know, in normal search engines is to say plus red and sponge. What does plus red do in, let's say, Google or Yahoo? If you say plus red, red must be present. There is no partial match on red. If you don't have red, you won't be a result. Okay? So what, by putting a plus next to the red, you have made the weight for red infinity. And then everything else, the weight becomes zero in comparison. Okay? And the other thing I told you is try and see if you can say red sponge versus red sponge and whether you'll get different results. Anybody tried? What happens? You get different results. So what is Google doing? It actually is saying red sponge is 3 reds, I mean 4 reds and 1 sponge. And so it's actually giving a different weight for that. Okay? That's basically vector similarity metric. So with respect to our example, this is what the document would become if you do TF-IDF weighting of the document. And, you know, stare at it, one of the homework questions would be to show that this actually becomes this using the ideas of TF-IDF that I just showed you. Now, so that you can check. You know, so I gave you the answer, you just have to make sure that it's the answer. Okay, so this one has 24219003, it now becomes 2.53, 14.56, 4.600, 2.07. Notice, very interestingly, this one is 24, this one is 21, right? Yeah. But once normalized, this became 2.53 and this became 14.56. What possibly could be the reason? The reason must be that this somehow is even rarer than the other one. Okay? Of course, zeros remain zeros, because if you have zero frequency to begin with, you will still remain zero after normalization. So this is how the documents would look after TF-IDF. So obviously these vectors are pointing in a different direction than these vectors, right? And then you take the same query, database and index. Here is what would have been the similarities between this query and each of the documents if you just did normal weighting with respect to these. No TF-IDF. And if on the other hand you did TF-IDF, then you would have gotten this as the similarity. And you can stare at it and see whether it somehow makes more sense. Okay? I mean, clearly you would agree that if a word is highly common, it should not count for anything. But then when you converted that into log of n over ni, you are comfortable with extremes. You know that if it is in every document, it should be ignored. If it's only one document, it should be given huge amount of weight. But when you took that into an analytical formula, log of n over ni, you are essentially making statements about, you know, if it is 15 times, if it's present in 15% of the documents versus it's present in 19% of the documents, how do you give the weight? You just made a statement, right? And so you may or may not like the results actually, but this is what you get. Okay? Yes?
This is technical, but for the purpose of the calculation, we are assuming log of 0 is defined as 0. Not the rest of the log of 0.
Yes.
Okay.
And also, normally people take, I believe, logger than to base 2. I don't remember. I think I have a little, when I add this homework question asking you to do this, show that this is the case, I will tell you which logarithms would give you these answers, you know. So, but doesn't really matter. To get the exact answer, you have to use the same logarithms that guy used. I think it's probably logarithm to the base 2, because information theory is normally log to the base 2. Okay. Here is the summary of vector models. In fact, here is the summary of whatever we did till now. But we considered bag models, so we considered three models. We considered Boolean model, which is set model. Then we considered bag model. Then we considered vector model. Okay? And based on what you thought was your document, you then defined similarity metrics over it. Okay? The one that is most popular in the IR community is the vector similarity, vector model and cosine theta similarity and TF-IDF weight. That's the most popular. Okay? The only reason is it seems to do better on the track competition. Okay. Now, the vector one very big issue, of course, is so what are the good things about vector models? You know, so this is what the vector model is usually as good as any of the other known alternatives. That's what we're saying, you know, to say that's the reason we're looking at it. And it's also simple and fast to compute. Now, the fast to compute part, some people can take, you know, issue with it, because computing cosine theta is not as easy as taking Jaccard similarity. Okay, but that's been done. It's mostly done that way. Now, normally the term weighting improves the quality of the answer set. This has nothing to do with vector model. I hope you understand this. You could have used this with bag similarity. Partial matching allows retrieval of documents. Again, this has nothing to do with vector model. It could have been anything other than Boolean model would allow you partial similarity. Okay, cosine ranking. I told you why cosine is slightly better than the Euclidean distance. Okay, now the distance. What are the disadvantages? Now, let's forget about all other guys and just think in terms of vectors, because that seems to be working. For now onwards, unless I tell you otherwise, we'll think of documents as vectors in the space of terms. And maybe, you know, unless I tell you otherwise, I'll just assume that it is non-normalized vectors. That means you don't do TF-IDF weighting, although it's a good idea to do. Okay. Normally, the problem with this, I mean, there should be many, many problems with this. Because remember that we are taking a document and converting it to a bag of a set of words, you know, bags of words. It makes no sense, you know. So, where do we start as to why this is going to fail? You know, but here are some, in practice, some ways, you know, why it seems to be very hard to deal with it. One is, the biggest issue is, when you have dimensions for a vector, what's the most important thing about the dimensions of a vector? They are orthogonal dimensions. So if you have an XYZ space, X is orthogonal to Y and Y is orthogonal to Z. What does that mean? What it means is, suppose you have a 10,000 dimensional vector, 10,000 dimensions, so x1 to x10,000 dimensions vector space. I have a vector in my hand and I tell you its coefficient from 1 to 9999. You still can't get the 10,000 one. Okay? Telling you anything about the other dimensions doesn't tell you anything about any other dimension. So, if I tell you here is a 10,000 dimensional vector, can you guess what is the coefficient for the last dimension? You say, eh? Then I'll tell you here is 9,999 of the first dimension. Can you tell me what is the last dimension? You say, eh? That's what it means to be independent. No information is provided by knowing other dimensions. That's what orthogonality means. Is that true? We are, remember that in our document space, we are saying keywords are dimensions. Suppose one keyword is computer, another keyword is science. Telling you that my document contains two instances of computer doesn't tell you anything at all about science. Suppose I tell you I have a document, how many instances of science do you think it will have? You'll say, I don't know. I'll say, well, I have 5 instances of computer. What do you think it has now? Would you still say, I don't know? Or would you at least change your belief as to whether there is computer, whether there's going to be science in it or not? You change. Why? Because they are not independent. We're just kidding ourselves. The keywords are not independent. If they are not independent, they are correlated. That means telling you something exists tells you whether other things exist or not. Okay? Now, correlation essentially means that basically much of the theory of vector distances, etc., assumes that you have independent basis. That means orthogonal basis dimension. And if you don't, then taking distances between vectors makes no sense. Okay, to understand this, think of the following scenario. I have document D1 and I only really have let's say K1, K1, K2, not even computer. Okay, document D1 has 5 instances of K1, 7 of K2. D2 has 10, 4, let's say. Now, imagine somebody adding new words to this document. One word is called 2K1 plus 3K2. And its value would be 2 times 5 plus 3 times 7. Okay, 10 plus 21, 31. And then another one would be 7 times K1 minus 8 times K2. Another one would be K1 square plus K2 square. Another one would be, how many of these can I write? Infinite number of them. As I am doing this, do you think the document meaning should have changed? These are made up words which are completely dependent on the previous word. So you would like to believe that the similarity between these documents should not have changed as these extra words are being added. In fact, if you think in terms of vector spaces, matrices, this is still a two-dimensional vector. But you are making it look like a n-dimensional vector where n is very large. Okay? Now the problem is, when you do that, all the distance measures go for a toss. Because the distance between this and this is not going to be the same as the distance between this whole thing and this whole thing. Depending on what distance measures you are using between the vectors. Okay? Now, when you have correlated words, in some sense, this is what is happening. So whenever you have computer, suppose you wind up having a science, then computer science together is just one word. You know, counting computer separately from science, you're basically doing that sort of a made-up word. Okay? This sort of talks about a fundamental notion of inherent dimensionality of a vector. You can take a vector of two dimensions and make it look like it's a 20-dimensional vector. Okay, and you need to know what is the true dimensionality of the vector. Back to linear algebra. Remember matrices? Matrices, right? Do you remember the notion of rank of a matrix? All of these you're going to read up over the weekend, because these are all going to be very important next week. Okay? It turns out that you can take a matrix. So this is a matrix. 5, 7, 10, 4. And then I can, so by the way, not only can I do this, I can also do this. I have a document called 2D1 plus 4D2. That's another document now. I made up a new document. This is basically sort of a concatenation of 2 times of D1 and 4 times D2. Okay? So what I'm doing in doing this is, I took a real matrix of this size and I'm making it bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay? As long as this is a tricky issue, let's not look at this part. I'm here, I'm doing K1 square plus K2 square. That's a nonlinear dependency between the new keyword and the old keyword. As long as you only have linear dependencies, then you can ask a question. Given a huge big matrix, what is its true dimensionality? And the answer is, find out its rank. Rank is the largest sized square submatrix of the matrix which has non-zero determinant. You're going to go back and read, desperately read all the linear algebra between now and next Tuesday. You know, I'll send you all the links again, but they're all there on the reading list. Because next Tuesday onwards, we'll be talking about latent semantic indexing, which completely depends upon these sorts of notions. Okay? So in some sense, if you know the rank, you would be able to know the true dimensionality. Okay? If, in fact, dependencies are only linear. If they are non-linear, God help you. You can't do it by matrix theory. You have to do something more. But the bigger issue is that assuming independence of index terms is dicey. It's really, really bad. Okay. Another issue is it does not handle synonymy and polysemy. That means the normal, even after TF-IDF weighting, if I said, you know, Mercedes in the keyword query, and there is a document which has been car, it won't realize that Mercedes is the same as Ben and bring, you know, bring them back. In general, any synonyms it won't know. Okay? Now, obviously it's not surprising because you don't do any language processing. Okay? So one idea could be to actually, you know, this is not handled, so you may want to handle it. The other issue is polysemy, which is a single word, bush, has 15 different meanings. Synonymy is that a word has the same meaning as some other word, and that other word is present in the document. You are looking for this word, so that document should be relevant to you. You won't give it. Okay? Polysemy means you have multiple meanings, and you need to differentiate between them. Now, those are also, it turns out, are connected to this notion of dependency between keywords. Okay, so these are all the prices that we are paying. I mean, the, you know, things are coming to roots now because we likely assume that keywords are dimensions for the vector, which is bogus. So now, what we are trying to do for the next couple of classes is try to patch a couple of these really big holes and see if we can get by to deal with some of the problems. Okay, and then of course, you know, the query weighting part is less important, I think. Okay. Okay, so this is basically the next set of slides, and I start by saying so many things can go wrong with vector space similarity metric, and then you shouldn't be surprised. First of all, document representation does lose information. You're using bag of words, you know, obviously you should at least be using something better. So if you, let's say, start considering noun phrases and think, you know, computer science becomes a single word, That would be a better idea than thinking of computer and science as different words. Okay? More importantly, suppose you consider a shingle representation of data document. Shingle. A shingle is essentially k words together. So suppose I'm looking for three shingles, right? And suppose my document is W1, W2, W3, W4, W5, W6. Okay, its word representation would be W1, W2, W3, W4, W5, W6. Its shingle representation would be W1, W2, W3, W2, W3, W4, W3, W4, W5, and so on. This will make sure that some of the word ordering information that was completely lost when you converted a document into a bag is going to be retained now. Because if computer and science are always occurring together, they would be part of a three shingle always. Okay? If you use this, you can get better similarity information between documents. Why don't we use this? What? If you do full text indexing, then the number of keywords you have is equal to the size of the vocabulary of the English language. Okay? Which is bad enough. I mean, given your GRE score, you know that it's pretty bad, right? And starting from there, now you are saying you are actually considering three shingles, all three combinations of words. That's hugely more cubes of the vocabulary. So you're increasing the dimensionality. You are increasing the dimensionality. Okay? So that's the price, and you're not willing to pay that price. By the way, you know where people do use shingle representation? Plagiarism detection. Imagine, you know, many, many places now, right? I mean, in the high schools and, you know, when you write a term paper, they turn it over through a turn it over system, which basically tries to see if it has too many surprising similarities with respect to other people's term paper on the same subject. Because, I mean, there are only so many term papers, right? I mean, write about civil rights movement, and everybody has written it. And, you know, it's just the temptation is too high to just copy it over. Take one, you know, this much from here, this much from here, this much from here, put it together. That'll be a new term paper. So you want to detect this plagiarism, or in fact digital detection of copyright infringement on the web scale. How do you do it when basically people take the exact same? So one obvious idea would be bag-based similarity. That would be bad, right? In fact, you could have written a completely different, semantically different essay, but it looks 0.9 similar to somebody else's essay only because both of you have equal-ish vocabulary and then you use approximately the same types of words. Okay? And you would not like to be told you're plagiarizing. So that would be bad for the student. What about the other extreme? Compute checksum for the entire file and compare checksum. These are fingerprints of the entire document. If the document fingerprints are the same, then they are equal. If not, they are not. This is bad for the teacher because all you need to do is copy over your entire friend's thing and put a comma in the middle. It's going to have a different checksum, right? So you need something in between. You do shingles. And the more shingles, the larger your shingles are, the more higher the probability that when you say it is a plagiarized copy, it is really a plagiarized copy. Okay? And in fact, one thing, remember this is also connected to something that we discussed in the beginning of the class, which is you want the results to be listed in the order of similarity to the query, but in the order of distance between each other. One might argue that the distance between the documents should be computed using the shingle, rather than using the bag similarity. because you really don't want the almost identical copies of the document. That's what you really are against. Okay, because otherwise, one of the useful things is, suppose you're trying to figure out on a particular news story, multiple opinions on the story. Okay, what did New York Times say about it? What did Al Jazeera say about it? What did the Hindu say about it? Now, if you only consider back similarity, it looks like all of them are very similar. If you consider checksums, they're all very different. But if you consider shingles, you can actually see which, you know, opinions seem to be significantly different from each other. Of course, you can always read it. Okay, that is always there. That's the elephant in the room. But we don't want to read. You know, we want to somehow get to the point where the top three most similar, most relevant but dissimilar from each other opinions are shown to you. Okay, so that's one way you can go wrong, and the shingle representation is the answer for that. I won't go too much on that anymore. User's inability to describe queries precisely. We will find a way for that called relevance feedback. It's actually very easy to do. Okay, and then the synonymy and polysemy, which we talked about, the same term has multiple meanings or multiple terms of same meaning. For that, we do ideas called clustering and latent semantic indexing. All of these are stopgaps. None of them are foolproof. Okay, but you shouldn't expect foolproof because these are English documents and you are trying to get by without knowing English. Okay. Let me just tell you the idea of relevance feedback and then you get to go home. I'll leave that there, but the simple idea is very easy to understand. So suppose the user gave a query Q. Right? User gave a query Q. Imagine that there are only two keywords. Okay? User gave a query Q, and you, using your current vector similarity, whatever method, figured out that the top 10 are D1, D2, etc., D10. Okay? And then you showed these to the user. Right? You only showed the first 10 pages, first 10 results right now. You showed these to the user. Now, suppose the user is nice. And so for each of them, you put a little thing like this and saying, click, tick if relevant, and cross if irrelevant. Suppose. Okay? So the user put tick here, cross here, cross here. So in the top 10 documents, the user said, told you, which one, which subset of the documents are relevant, which subsets of documents are irrelevant. Now you are about to show him the next 10 results. Should you just go with the next 10 results that you already have cached, or should you take this information into account? You should take this information into account because previously that query was something like, you know, K1 and K2, and now he's giving more information. He or she is giving you more information. Really what I'm looking for are these sites and not these sites. Think of the following more extreme case. Suppose the user not only gave you the query, but also gave you the exact set of documents that are relevant, and the exact set of, and the rest of the documents are irrelevant. If they gave it to you upfront. And now you are trying to figure out what should have been the user's query such that your dump method would have given the right result. So what you should do is clearly all the relevant documents. So if you are trying to look for a new document, you know, D11, it's going to be relevant in as much as it is closer to D1 and let's say D9, etc. All the ones which are relevant. It should be as close as possible to all the relevant documents. At the same time, it should be as far away as possible to all the irrelevant documents. If I'm trying to find out a vector which is closest in a cumulative sense to n other vectors, there's a simple way. The mean of these vectors would be the one that is closest to all the vectors in terms of the distance. Okay, so if nothing is irrelevant, and if you only tell me what is relevant, then I should start looking for a query which is the average of all the documents that are relevant. Average of all the documents that are relevant. Okay? Now, if there are also irrelevant ones, then subtract from that the average of all the documents that are irrelevant. This will be your new query vector. How hard is that? Extremely easy. The previous query was a vector, new query is a vector. Okay? And what's more interesting is previous query was just saying K1 and K2, but now I know actually what you're looking for. These documents have a lot more keywords. And so you really know, suppose I said Bush, and I'm clicking on Kalahari Bush, Africa Bush, etc., etc., and I'm saying, you know, no to Republican Bush and whatever else, then you know that the query essentially is Bush plus Kalahari minus Republican. That's relevant feedback. So the next 10 results are going to be based on what you told me till now. This improves, you know, so rather than ask user what you're looking for, you see what they're doing and then change what you show next. This is like the sari shop example, where you first start showing a bunch of saris, you know, and then based on what they're, you know, longingly looking at, you start changing the rest of the ones that you show. This is a simple enough idea. Next class, we'll talk about clustering and latent semantic indexing. I mean, correlation analysis and latent semantic indexing.